My friends, I am nothing if not predictable. And while it is true that I am indeed affected by Shakespeare's adage that foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds, still I have become a slave to my high holy day traditions. Last night, I used a parable to usher in this very special season. This is something I have done now for 8 years, and barring any reasonable criticism, and I judge what's reasonable, of course, I will continue that tradition. This morning, I would like to share with you insights from a book, yet another tradition of mine. Perhaps you remember some books from the past. The Life of Pi, The End of Faith, The Shack, Eat, Pray, Love, The Glass Castle. All deep, thoughtful books with meaningful messages. Now, before I tell you about the book for this year, let me preface my words by explaining that I was somewhat conflicted with my choice. In truth, I wanted to discuss a different book, but to put it bluntly, I didn't have the courage. However, as a nod to the book that did not get selected, I have worn a gray tie this morning. It is my sincere hope that you like this particular shade. And yes, for the men who are looking around and not getting the joke, feel free to ask your wife or significant female friend to explain it to you. Who knows, perhaps it will spark an intriguing conversation. Okay, before I distract us any further, back to this year's book. Actually, it is not one, but three. You see, this summer I became somewhat obsessed by the notion of time. What does time mean? How can we understand time? How can we value time? Is it as absolute, this notion of time, as I think? And so, intrigued by the title, I began with the book, What Money Can't Buy, written by Harvard professor Michael Sandel. I was certain, before ever picking up this book, that his final conclusion would be predictable. It would be that money can't buy time. I was wrong. He went out of his way to describe that money very much can buy time. Easy pass on the highways, fast pass at Disney World. You can even pay someone to stand in line for you for a ticket for Shakespeare in Central Park. In the end, Sandel notes that there are still some things money can't buy. He points out that values, integrity, sincerity, unfortunately, time is not one of those things. Time is most certainly purchasable. As a result, we live in a society that values multitasking. The more we can do in a single day, the more productive we can be, then the happier we'll be. But this is so clearly wrong. You know, from time to time, I can be spotted exercising at Big Vanilla. Not often, but from time to time. Generally, I get on the elliptical and I listen to a lecture or a book on an iPod. While listening to this stuff certainly succeeds in making the time on the exercise machine pass faster, still, after the fact, my comprehension of that lecture or that book is woefully lessened. In fact, oftentimes I need to listen to it a second time, really, to understand what the content was. And why? Because while our brains have the capacity to do so many wonderful things, still, our brains have neurologically inscribed parameters. You see, our brains are like record players. You know, I'm talking about old-fashioned record players. Anyone under the age of 35 has no idea what I'm talking about. When you put a record on a turntable, and I know that I should probably take it this really slow, but okay. And then I'll describe what a phone booth is later. But when you put a record on a turntable and you play it at the appropriate speed, out emanates beautiful music. However, if you take a record meant for, stay with me, 33 speed, and you play it at 78 speed, which is faster, it's not music anymore. It sounds squeaky. It sounds unenjoyable. It's not music. Our brains work at a speed with parameters. So contrast this with the second book I read. The title of this book was Time by Eva Hoffman. Hoffman claims that as a result of technology and modernity, many people all across the world, but most notably Americans, have fixated on the notion of defying time. She says that while she agrees that taking money from an ATM certainly beats standing in line at the bank, and renewing library books online certainly beats going to the library straight yourself to renew a book, still, we as Americans have all but forgotten the value of taking things slow. Sandel's book, he speaks about how we try to pile as many things into a single minute or a single hour or a single day as we can. Hoffman's book, she advocates for taking things slow. She suggests that if you take things slow, you will, in the end, have more. Now, you know, the early Greeks described time in two different ways. The first way is something called chronos. This described time on the move. Time is before and after. The time we observe when we look at our watches. Think about some English words that come from the Greek word chronos. When an illness is chronic, it lasts a long time. Or a chronicle is an account of events through a sequence of time. Or a chronology is the itemized, studied measurement of time. If you can measure the time, it's chronos. In addition to chronos, however, the Greeks also spoke of time as a moment, time as an occasion, time as qualitative rather than quantitative, time as significant rather than dimensional. The second word for time is kairos. Strictly speaking, we don't measure kairos. We don't ask someone, for example, how much Pesach did you have? We inquire rather, how was your Pesach? With kairos, it's about quality and not quantity. If I could offer you one important message at this moment, a Rosh Hashanah message, to be sure. Notice the Keros. You see, in order to feel the enchantment of the world around us and the relationships that we have, we need to be receptive to them and not just mired in forward determination. So the third book. It was written 20 years ago. And I picked it off my shelf because I remembered how much I loved it when I read it back then. It's called Einstein's Dreams, written by Alan Lightman. So listen to a brief excerpt. "There's a place where time stands still," he writes. "Raindrops hang motionless in the air. Pendulums of clocks float mid-swing. Dogs raise their muzzles in silent howls. Pedestrians are frozen on the dusty streets, their legs cocked as if held by strings. For this is the center of time. From this place, time travels outward in concentric circles. It is at rest at the center, slowly picking up speed at greater diameters." Okay. I know it seems a bit out there, but the premise of this book is that in 1905, Albert Einstein was working out his theory of relativity, which would obviously revolutionize the way we think about time. He was so obsessed with it that at night he would dream about different worlds where time worked differently than it did in our universe. For example, in one dream there was a world where time runs backwards. Or another one, people grow younger day by day until they become infants. He dreamed of a world where time runs in circles and everything that ever happened happened again after a certain interval. In yet another dream, he considers a world where time passes more slowly at higher elevations. So the rich people build their houses on mountaintops and live on the top floors of those houses. The time will pass more slowly and they will have a few more hours to live longer than they would if they had lived at a lower altitude. But the passage that remained with me after I'd finished the book, and perhaps even the point of this sermon, was the one I shared with you just a moment ago, about a world where time stands still and nothing ever changes. You see, there is a part of me, and I suspect a part of every one of us, that would like to have the power to make time stand still. Now, I'm not talking about the feeling that you get when you're on the beach, reading a good book, wishing that the fun and relaxation would never end. I'm talking about the part of us that recognizes how tough change can at times be. Young children don't get this. For a young child, time passes too slowly. A young child is always trying to hurry up time, to get to their next birthday, to get to their next milestone. No car seat, a driver's license, graduation, quicker, quicker, quicker. But for the rest of us, time just passes all too quickly. Has it really been a whole year since the last time we were together for Rosh Hashanah? It feels like just yesterday. You know, when people see me with all four of our kids, two of them are here with us, they love to tell me stuff. With striking regularity, there is one piece of parenting advice that is offered to me and to Hannah over and over again. The advice, and many of you in the sanctuary have offered it to us. The advice people regularly say to us is that we should appreciate or enjoy or cherish these years. They continue by saying, you continue by saying, in an instant, the kids are out of the house and the moments are gone. A lot of people know what I'm talking about. We nod in agreement. We know. We've been told. But how can I explain my true feeling about time? The days can be extraordinarily long at times. Somehow and amazingly, they do seem to fly by. So who is the person that Einstein in his dream was talking about? travels to the still point in time that he dreamed of. Parents with children, people in love, and of course, those of us who feel like our bodies are changing for the worse, the aches and pains of aging, the weight gain. If we could just stay where we are, if we could just have our bodies functioning the way it usually does, if we could just run the marathon like we once did, we would just want no changes, security. But one of the messages of Rosh Hashanah is that there is no stopping time. The future might give us anxiety, but there is no way of making time stand still. Any of you opera buffs? I remember going to an opera with my family many, many, many years ago. My parents, I mean. I went to the opera Der Rosenkavalier. Talk about an opera. It felt like it went on forever. The waltz scenes were lovely, but a little lengthy. I wish Richard Strauss had tried to multitask a little bit better. Put it all into just maybe an hour and a half. Anyway, there is one very poignant scene in the opera Der Rosenkavalier, and it's how the aging Marceline realizes that her younger lover is destined to leave her. So do you know what she does? She stops all the clocks in the palace so that she will not be reminded of the passing of time. What a poignant gesture. Poignant because we all know of its futility. Stopping the clocks does not mean stopping time. It just means stopping what we know the time to be. Judaism reminds us that change can be scary. Yes, it can. Worse, though, is refusing to change. Do you remember the story of Sodom and Gomorrah? Three angels were sent to Sodom and Gomorrah to destroy the towns on account of their wickedness. However, before destroying the towns, the angels tell the only innocent resident, a guy by the name of Lot, who just so happens to be Abraham's nephew. But he tells Lot, the angels tell Lot, flee from Sodom with your wife and with your family. But there is a proviso. They say, don't look back. What do you know? As they are fleeing, Lot's wife does look back. And you know what happens? She turns into a pillar of salt. And I've always been fascinated by the fact that she turns into a pillar of salt. Why not a stone pillar? A salt pillar. Salt pillar because salt is a preservative. The more you need to keep something fresh for future consumption, the more salt you add to it. Lot's wife was turned into a pillar of salt because she was stuck in the past. She was unable to look into the future. Now, Judaism is not unique in teaching that time does not stand still, despite what Einstein might have dreamed. However, our tradition can help us deal with the anxiety that many of us have of the unknown future. Judaism reminds us that we should not be afraid of the future, not because we have any assurances that the future will be good, but rather because it wants to reassure us that we have the resources, the personal and the communal, to cope with whatever the future has in store. Judaism's promise is not that it can keep us safe, but that it can make us strong. Strong enough to overcome whatever the new year might bring. A baby naming is done with a family and community to reassure us that we are not alone in the daunting task of caring for a child. The rituals of a bar mitzvah help us grow personally as we watch our teens mature. The comfort of a Jewish funeral helps us feel cared for at a time of terrible crisis and uncertainty. Judaism does give us the tools. It doesn't keep us safe, but it can make us strong. The story in our book of Frozen Time, it ends in a very sad way. You see, only at the center of this place does time stand still. The further you get away from the center, the faster time passes. So when the lover, or the parent, or the healthy individual return to their original places, the places which created such beautiful feelings and compelled these people to go to the center of the universe to stop time, when they get back to these places, they find that the world has passed them by. All friends are gone. After all, lifetimes have passed. They move in a world that they do not even recognize, so the story finishes. They now feel alone in the fact that they did not move with the flow of time. And so on this Rosh Hashanah, when we too feel the worries of next year, that's how it goes for us. We worry. We're Jews. That's what we do. So in this Rosh Hashanah, this new year, my message to you is, do not be afraid. Don't be afraid of change. Change is not always bad. Change can be good. And it usually is very good. Don't be afraid that life might hurt. It may, but you can handle it. And you have loved ones in a community, a Jewish community, to support you. Today is Rosh Hashanah. One door may very well be closing behind us. But more importantly, a new door before us is opening. Go through that door. You are not alone. We are all going through that door together. Shema Tova.